Sarah, you didn't fall asleep again, did you?
No. No, I'm here. I'm here. All systems nominal, Command.
Roger. Sarah, can I say that I'm so glad you decided to return to Aqua? Your mother's disappearance was hard on all of us. I want you to know that. Alex was one of our best recruits, just like you.
Please. I'm here to build the future. And I need the money. Actually, right now, the money is the best thing for me to focus on. So if you don't mind.
Right. Back to business. We need to find out what's causing those energy surges before we can continue base operations. This is your top priority.
Hello, Spacers. From Austin, Texas, Christopher Schmidt. Now, today's show, I'm joined with Nick Pettit. Nick is a teacher at Treehouse, which is an online web education company. He's also an independent VR game developer. On November 15th, he releases his first major game called Neptune Flux. Neptune Flux can be experienced on VR headsets like the Oculus Rift, HTC Vive, and PlayStation VR, but you can also play it on a PC, Mac, and PlayStation 4 as well. Before we get started, some notes on where I'll be and some words from our sponsors. CCSFConf 2016 The Alamo is almost here. It's taking place October 17th to the 18th in San Antonio, Texas. Learn from great speakers like Chris Coyer, Jen Simmons, Snook, Trent Walton, Sarah Drasner, Estelle Weil, and so many more. There's still time to register at CSSDevConf.com. Again, that's CSSDevConf.com. The ATX Web Film Series is showing documentaries What Comes Next is the Future and The Code Bridging the Gender Gap on October 3rd at the Alamo Drafthouse Theater on South Mar. So if you live in Austin, Texas, and you're free, please come check it out. Matt, the director of What Comes Next is the Future, is going to be there in person. We're going to have panel discussions about our industry after the two films. It's sort of like a mini tech film festival. You can check out more details at atxwebfilmseries.com. Did you know that you could set it and forget it with a non-breaking space show newsletter? Whenever a new episode is ready, you have it delivered straight to your inbox just by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. As always, you can find show notes and links discussed in today's episode at nonbreakingspace.tv. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. And as always, thank you for subscribing, commenting, liking, and telling others about Non-Breaking Space Show. Now, engage. Yeah, again, thanks for being on the show, and wanted to have you on the show for a while, actually. So let's talk about your role over at Treehouse, but also what you're working on right now, the game development project that they're working on, and stuff like that. But we always ask the question is, how'd you get involved in the web? What was your first exposure to the web? And what made you decide to focus a lot of stuff on the web initially?
I think when I was 10 or 11 years old, I remember being exposed to Front Page, and I liked it because it was this tiny part of my life that I could exert some kind of control over. My dad was doing some stuff with Front Page. He's done quite a lot of web stuff, and he showed me that I can drag out a table and start putting images in it, and that's how I was able to lay out my site. And when I saw that, I was like, this is pretty cool. I can make a website the way I want to make it. I think it was around then that I first got exposed to it, and what, like, that wasn't really the moment where I was like, oh yeah, this is definitely what I'm gonna do for a career. It was sort of just a parallel thread that was there for a long time, and I kind of just did off and on until I got a little bit more serious about it, and probably in college.
So what websites were you building at 10 and 11 years old?
I I remember I was 11, and I remember that because my mom showed me an article in the newspaper, and another kid had created the 10-year-old page. And I thought, oh my gosh, my career is over. I've been beaten by 1 year. But I was just, you know, it was really kind of just like a personal website.
Right.
I think I put up like my own strategies for games I was playing at the time. I put up like pictures of the family dog. You know, it was kind of just all the things that are going on in the mind of an 11-year-old, I guess.
Yeah.
Well,
that's good. Yeah. Like, because when I teach the basics, like of web design and stuff, it's really hard for some people who don't have that computer background to grasp. And I always tell them to pick up a hobby or some sort of passion that they like to, and build a web page for that, because it's a lot easier when you're designing content that you love. And then, because you have the hurdle of learning technology and even the basic things like file names and folder structures, you know, that they probably weren't ever exposed to. So, but I was interested, because like most people I talk to, it's they build their websites for bands they like. So
yeah, that's pretty common. So, you know, it's interesting you mentioned folder structures because in just the past couple of years, that's actually something that we've had to focus a little bit more on at Treehouse. And I've been teaching at Treehouse for 6 years now. And when I first started, you know, we taught basic front end stuff, and I don't know, files and folders never really came up a whole lot as a specific standalone topic. And as the years went on, you know, we made lots more courses, the company grew, we refreshed some of the first courses we did, actually several times. We built a forum, and something that kept coming up in the forum was students that didn't know where they saved files. They said, I saved my index.html, I don't know where it is. And I'm like, how do you not know where this is? Like, I couldn't figure it out. I was like, what are we doing wrong here? Because it kept coming up over and over and over. Like, it started getting more frequent. And I finally figured out, you know, that a lot of students don't have exposure to the file system. And I was like, yeah, I mean, when would they? Because Facebook is just kind of in the browser, or like an app on your phone, and that's how you listen to music. It's just all in like Spotify or something. And it, you know, they didn't have the same experience I did of stealing music off of Napster and organizing all of it into nice files and folders, right? That's how I learned growing up. So I was like, yeah, wow, that makes total sense. Files and folders are actually starting to become a little bit more of a programmer-y thing. Anyway, kind of aside, but yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it becomes an issue because I taught at my college, my alma mater, for a while, and then I taught online for a while, and it was always a hard thing because you're kind of distance yourself when you teach online. And you're trying to teach someone like, hey, file names and file structures. And if they're not exposed to it, and especially with the iOS devices, when they don't need to be worried about file names and structures, like you just said, it was just like, and subscriber services where you're not really owning the content anymore, right? It's not like a Blu-ray disc. Like, you're like, hey, I'm putting it into a folder, you know, it's like, or your email, because your email is just, you know, with Gmail, it's always archived somewhere, you know, it's always in the cloud. So you don't have to, it never disappears. So, and so when you're trying to tell someone like, no, you have to be very specific about where you're pulling this from, they're like, why? Like, why? Like, well, that's computers. That's how they work. So. So how did you patch that up, or like how you address it?
Well, I mean, when we were going through another round of course refreshes, I saw it coming up more and more frequently. I mean, we didn't let it blow up into a massive problem, but I was like, okay, this is like something we're going to need to actually talk about in the course. Another solution we came up with that addressed a number of problems, that one included, is what we call workspaces, which is basically it's a text editor in the browser, but it's also more than that because you know you can spin up servers, get access to the console. Behind the scenes, you're basically spinning up a virtual machine when you open up a Treehouse workspace, and you know it's all contained and secure and stuff. We had a few instances in the past where we discovered things after the fact, but it's pretty patched up at this point. But that helps solve it a little bit in the more beginner courses. And eventually, you know, we like students to kind of graduate to running things locally and, you know, stuff like that. But that kind of gets over the initial hurdle of like just getting started with HTML, things like that. Yeah.
And then what type of games were you playing? Because you said you built web pages for strategies for games.
Yeah. It was real-time strategy games. So pretty much the Blizzard games at the time. So Warcraft and Starcraft were the ones I was super duper into growing up. Yeah.
What was your first, I guess, job dealing with web?
My first job was as just self-employed, basically. It was all like all the most horrible stuff you don't want to do. So just like no contracts, no nothing. I was like 14 or 15 years old. Just over the summer, I was like, yeah, I know some people that need websites and logos and things, and just kind of. just started doing that. And then I guess professionally, it'd probably be while I was still in college, I got an internship at a healthcare consulting firm, and that ended up turning into a full-time job. So there I was writing PHP, and it was for this database that had millions and millions of records, all, you know, a lot of it containing sensitive HIPAA data. So we always had to be very careful about that because there's pretty strict requirements around that. Like if you have one slip up, it's pretty much the end of the company. So that was a good first exposure to like real code, I guess, because I mean, when I first came in for like the first week, I was thinking about just quitting and telling my boss, saying like, you know what? I'm sorry, I wasted your time. I'm in way over my head here. I have no idea what I'm doing. And then after like a month or two, I realized it was actually just the code that was really awful, not my lack of understanding. And so I was like, okay, so that is what my job here really is about, is untangling this mess. And so by the time I left there, we had done a pretty good job of getting it object oriented. We transferred a lot of software over to Ruby on Rails because that was kind of the new hotness at the time. Mm-hmm.
Where were you at this time? Like
what geographically?
Where was college? You said like.
So I went to school at UCF, so the University of Central Florida in Orlando.
Go Knights.
Yeah, that's right. That's where I currently live. I still am in Orlando. So I've been in Orlando about 10 years. But I grew up in Clearwater, Florida. So yeah, so didn't go far. Went to Orlando and then got a job at a school while I was still in school and just kinda stuck around because it was convenient, low cost of living. I like, you know, not having snow. So, yeah.
I lived in Orlando for a while. It's pretty nice. Yeah. I used to work for a company called Mind Comet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I'm familiar.
So, work for a healthcare company. PHP, Rails, object oriented. So what was your next gig after that, or job?
Next thing after that was Treehouse.
Treehouse. Okay.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you. Is that
sure?
How long were you at the healthcare job before
exactly
you?
3 years to the day.
3 years to the day. And then what were you doing? Doctype videos? Were they called Doctype at the time?
Yes.
Yes,
it was. So,
And what was Doctype? So people who don't know.
Yeah. So Doctype was a video podcast where each week we would teach a web design topic and a web development topic. And I did it with my buddy Jim Hoskins. And we did that for, I think, about a year and a half. And basically, we started it while we were at this healthcare company because we wanted to do something together. I mean, we met each other actually in college at the Game Developers Club.
Oh, wow.
So we met there because we both wanted to make video games, and then we realized that's really hard, and so we got into more web stuff pretty quickly there. But yeah, so we had a podcast, but that wasn't the first thing we did. We actually started a company because we wanted to do, we wanted to do something together. We wanted to collaborate somehow. So we started the company thinking we would do client work. So we started, just seeking out clients and, doing really small projects that we thought we could manage while going to school, while having our internships. And we realized we kind of hated it. We didn't like dealing with clients, and that wasn't really something that we wanted to do all the time. And so we were like, okay, so we don't want to do that. So we'll make apps. We'll have this suite of apps, just like 37 Signals, which is now known as Basecamp, of course. And, they had all their apps and were very prolific bloggers and all that. So we're like, yeah, we're going to make these apps, and we're going to just collect monthly recurring revenue, and everything's just going to be perfect. It'll be really easy.
Really easy. Okay.
Yeah. So we built like one or two different things to completion, or at least very close to completion. And by the time we got to the end of it, so one of them was like home inventory software, because my dad's an accountant. And so my dad was always harping on me about like making sure, I'm insured with everything, and all my ducks are in a row. And he's like, you really should get insurance for your stuff, or your, for this, that, and the other. And I was like, I can't catalog all my stuff. This is ridiculous. Like, how am I ever going to do that? So it's like, I bet we could make this home inventory app, make it really easy for people to inventory all of their physical belongings.
Right.
And then we could either have ads on the service, or have it be a paid thing. Or the one I was most interested in was partnering with insurance companies, kind of in the same way that Mint has like credit card offers and things like that. Right.
Right.
So anyway, we got pretty far with that. It was pretty cool. It had some interesting features. And when we were about to release it, we were like, do we really want this to be like potentially the next like 5 years of our lives where we're running this home inventory software thing and answering customer support, and the database goes out and then what? And we were just like, I don't think this is really what we want to do. I mean, we didn't spend a ton of time on it, maybe like 3 to 6 months or something, but certainly a good learning experience. But anyway, after all that, we were like, okay, well, we've learned a lot. Maybe we can teach some of the things we've learned to other people. And this was around the time where video blogging was kind of just starting to pick up traction. It was around like 2008, 2009. Of course, Gary Vaynerchuk had his show on Wine Library, and he like really influenced us a lot. We're like, yeah, we should do video blogging, because that's, that'll be really cool. So we started doing that, and that was pretty much what got us the job at Treehouse, which actually back then was called Think Vitamin. it was Think Vitamin membership. Think Vitamin was the blog. And you can already start to see why we rebranded to a totally different name, because it's really confusing to explain. Anyway, so we did that, and we were starting to get some sponsorships and stuff. It was going pretty well. We were thinking about kind of doing like a paid version of it, or, you know, we weren't really sure exactly what we were doing, but then we got in touch with Ryan Carson, and at the time he was running his events business. So he had, you know, Future Web Design, Future Web Apps, stuff like that, and he had his business Carsonified, and we were going to these events on the dime of the healthcare company, and we were going to the one in Miami. It was Future Web Apps or Future Web Design. I can't remember which one. And it was in February of 2010. And we were doing our podcast Doctype, and we emailed Ryan, and we were like, hey, can we come interview some of your speakers? Like, that would be really great for our podcast. And he was like, yeah, of course, whatever. Yeah, sure. Like, and they actually set us up in a little press room, and I was like, this is super cool. And so we did that, and that's how we first met Ryan. And then, you know, a couple months go by, and in May of 2010, he tweeted that he was looking for a designer and a developer that could do screencasts. And I emailed Jim right away. I was like, dude, this is us. Like, we already have a ton of episodes to prove that we can do this on video. So we emailed Ryan, and he was like, oh man, I thought you were like super successful or whatever already. And we're like, no, we're just, you know, just got our first jobs out of college here. Like, we're, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's the rest is history, as they say.
That's kind of cool. It's like kind of interesting how perceptions are different online to different people. So
totally. Sure. Yeah, that's pretty
cool. All right, so that's how it all started, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's how Trios got started. It was just Jim and I in Orlando, and Ryan, it was in the UK, actually. Mm. And he lived there for about 10 years until he moved back to the United States, and he's in Portland, Oregon now. But yeah, for the first 6 months, it was just the three of us and a few different contract folks, and so pretty much every day, Jim and I would write a video and shoot it and upload it. So there'd be two new videos every day, which was kind of insane looking back. I don't know how we did that. It was a lot of hustle. Then the company kind of started to pick up momentum because... Actually, at the time, so this is a funny story. At the time, I had a pretty steady job in healthcare, right? And had like 401k and, of course, health insurance since it's a healthcare company and all the niceties, right? And I saw this opportunity, and Ryan was basically like, well, we're going to try it out for 3 months. And if things don't work out, like, I'll help you guys get a job somewhere else. Like, and I trusted that because, of course, Ryan had his events business and had lots of great connections. So I was like, yeah, we could just like get a job at like Facebook or something, you know? Right. So I was like, this seems like a good roll of the dice for just being out of school. And like I said, my dad is an accountant, and he was very much against this idea.
Yeah.
He was like, this is not good. This seems like a risk. I don't know. And I just kind of went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like any parent, really.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, about a year into Treehouse, my dad, got laid off from the bank he was working at, And he was kind of like, gosh, I don't know what I should do. He was kind of considering early retirement or like a part-time job or something. And that same week, Ryan came to me and came to all of us and said, hey, do you guys know anybody, that is a really experienced accountant, but could work like part-time? I turned to everybody in the office that day. I was like, should I work with my dad? Do you think? I was like, yeah, I kind of owe it to him for, you know, raising me. Okay. So I was like, yeah, that sounds fine. I mean, I love my dad. He's great. And so I said, yeah, I know somebody, and he's been at the company ever since, like 5 years now. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, so he thought it wasn't a good idea, and now he works there too. So,
well, it's also our industry is so new. It's like I remember so many stories with my relatives, and then like I love the web, I love web design, and I wanted to go do this thing, and it's like, well, why? it's like
right.
Well, it just seems kind of like a fad. Like I don't think so. I think it's gonna be here for a while. So, but yeah. Right. But if you, I don't know, it's like a, if you love what you do, you just got to take the leap.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, definitely. And that's our moral for today, guys. Everyone who's listening, it's just like, Yep. Just take it. So
just do it.
Just do it. All right. Cool. And so that's all your treehouse. And treehouse is awesome. So just doing that. But I also want to talk to you today about games, and since we talked so far, games have been pretty important part of your life.
Yeah,
so
like I said, I mean, it's there's a lot of different threads, I think, in anybody's life, and Right. And that's kind of how games have been for me. Is I always loved playing games. I mean, I remember playing when I was a little kid, like 4 or 5 years old. I would play on our IBM PC. And so we didn't have internet at home yet at the time. But my dad had internet at the bank. Mm-hmm. So every day my dad would, like, you know, this was kind of like the shareware era. And so he would download like some kind of thing, you know, and bring it home on a floppy disk. And every day when my dad would come home and say, hey, dad, did you get like any new games today? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was great. He always had something. So he must have enjoyed it too. But I remember experiencing, like, I remember being like 5 years old and playing like Wolfenstein and Doom.
Oh, yeah. Wolfenstein, I mean, 3D. Oh.
Yeah. And you know, this was before the ESRB and any kind of rating system, right? So it was probably like horribly inappropriate for 5 year old. But I was like, wow, this is great. So that was kind of, I think, the first exposure to it that I really remember. And we were kind of a Nintendo household, so I remember growing up with an SNES and N64 and stuff. When I got to college, I waited in line for 2.5 days for a Nintendo Wii. Yeah, that happened.
So, but you never went to a computer store that looked like it was a hole in the wall in a strip mall.
So
and they had like their video games were on floppy disks.
In like the Ziploc bags?
Yeah.
No, so I never went to a computer store like that, but we did go to computer shows, okay. Which was like a thing at the time. And yeah, so there it would be at like some Floridian hotel or something. And they would have like this expo hall of like all things computers. They'd be selling like joysticks and all this stuff. And I remember that's where we bought Myst. Like, you know, there weren't a whole lot of CD-ROM games at the time. But that was like the one, right? Yeah. Everybody was raging about. And so we got that. And yeah, I remember buying lots of games that way, those computer shows. So that was always a fun thing. But yeah, I mean, after that, I guess it was in college. Like I said, I joined the Game Developers Club, and that is where I met Jim, and we ended up working at the healthcare company together and doing doc type and stuff. But I joined the Game Developers Club, and I didn't really know a whole lot about programming at the time. I've like messed around in Front Page and done some HTML stuff, but I like really hadn't done any actual if statements and logic and things before. And so I wasn't a whole lot of use to the Game Developers Club at first anyway. And so I went back to my dorm one night and I was like, all right, I really got to just like buckle down and learn this stuff. And so I bought C for Dummies and C++ for Dummies. And I read both those books cover to cover and, just kind of absorbed it. I got really into, building these little DOS games and, doing memory management in C++, and it was really fun, and I started doing some OpenGL programming and did a little bit of stuff in the Game Developers Club, nothing serious, but that didn't last too long, just because at the time, this was around like 2005, 2006, there weren't really a whole lot of great tools available for an independent game developer. Releasing on a console was nearly impossible. Steam was still kind of hitting its stride. It wasn't really kind of the de facto games marketplace yet. And the tools available to independent developers were almost non-existent. I mean, you were pretty much writing your own game engine. There was like one open source game engine that a lot of people used at the time, and it was not that good. So that's why I kind of shied away from it at the time. I was just like, this is too hard. I don't know how I'm ever going to get into this. The resources for learning it were kind of like, hey, read this big giant book and you can make a spinning multicolored triangle on the screen with OpenGL. And I said, great. And I discovered CSS and JavaScript, and I was like, this is great. This has the immediacy that I'm looking for, and the instant gratification of just typing something and seeing it work.
Yeah, so there's nothing that I hate more than a tutorial that will like finally teach me something I've been wanting to learn, but the end result is like some triangle or a rectangle, and then I can color it. I'm like, that
seems like step one, right? Yeah. You're like, I totally agree. And so I shied away from it, did web development for many, many years. And it was around 2013, I was kind of keeping my eye on games, I guess, through Twitter and stuff. I never lost my passion for playing games. I've played lots of games. I've taken weeks off work to play through games because I just want to play through them from beginning to end.
Right.
In 2011, I went to Seoul, Korea to watch StarCraft tournaments for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Like that wasn't a stop on the trip. It was
the trip.
The trip. Like, that was the purpose of the trip. So like, I love games. And it was around 2013 where I saw the Unity game engine started to really pick up steam at the time or pick up a lot of users and was getting a lot of interesting features. I saw the Kickstarter for the Oculus Rift happen. And it was towards the end of 2013 where I was like, you know, I need to reassess this. Like, I still want to be in games in some capacity. And I think maybe now, like almost 10 years later, it might be the right time for me to jump back in as kind of like a, not a low level programmer, but somebody with artistic and software interests. So my New Year's resolution, December 2013, was to make a video game. And so I set off in, you know, the first few months of 2014. And I thought I could complete it in about a year. And now I'm releasing that game in November 2016 this year. So it actually took about 3 years, not one.
That sounds like we're on target though, right?
Right. Yeah. No, for software. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But I think the thing I grossly underestimated was just how much I had to learn. Because, the thing I, erroneously calculated in was that, well, I've worked on lots of large scale applications before and lots of different types of websites and software projects. I was like, yeah, I can totally just handle a game and I'll just kind of learn it on the fly. But it's amazing how many different topics there are to know in making a game. It's highly interdisciplinary, just like making websites, really. And each one of those topics is incredibly deep. I mean, you know, you've graphics and game design and game audio and, you know, writing a compelling story and all these things that are like you could spend a lifetime on and never truly master. My game actually started out as like a side scroller. I thought I'd make like a simple 2D side scroller, kind of like, I don't know, Super Mario Brothers or something like that. And, I got this idea of like having this little, submarine kind of navigate through a cave system, and you'd have to kind of shine your floodlights into the right direction to see stuff.
Right. And that has like, just think about that. Just like that it sets a mood already, yeah. Sets a tone. Yeah. Like you don't know what's going on. It's, you kind of put the users, on edge a little bit without even going that far in the story. Right. That's just...
Exactly. I mean, and you know, I picked a side scroller and 2D graphics just because I thought that would be something that would be maybe a little bit easier and more tractable as a project. But then I saw that VR was really starting to, it looked like it was really going to take off. It was really getting some traction. And I was like, you know, if I'm just starting out in this and just starting a game right now, I should try to shoot for like the bleeding edge of what's really possible. And so I got to, I ordered my Oculus DK1 development kit. Mm-hmm. I was immediately like blown away. I was like, okay, yep, let's just throw out this whole side scroller idea completely. And what ended up happening is I took some of the ideas for the game and turned it into like this, this 3D VR game, where you are, you're in a deep sea dive pod and you're sort of navigating the ocean and looking for cool wreck sites. I didn't really have much of a concept for the game at that point, but I knew that I wanted that to be the setting, just because I thought it was interesting. I hadn't really seen a deep sea adventure game yet, and I wanted to do that. So, the thing that I noticed about VR right away and all of the demos I was trying was that there was a pretty deep emotional connection with the medium that I had not seen before in other mediums. And it was a lot more than just like a 3D movie or something like that, because you get sensory deprivation in the same way you do when you like put on really nice headphones or something. It's like headphones for your eyes almost, you know? And so it completely covers your peripheral vision, and you can look around in 360 degrees. And the other thing about VR is that you can see in stereo 3D. And it turns out that has a pretty powerful psychological effect, because a lot of our psychology is tied to binocular depth cues. Because when you're a cave person running from a saber-toothed tiger, you need binocular depth to judge the size and distance of various threats, right? So for those reasons, when you see in stereo 3D, you can feel a lot more of a range of emotions. So I think everybody's familiar with videos of people like freaking out when they're in VR because they're playing some kind of a horror game. And that's what goes viral on YouTube. But the same types of, you know, there's a whole range of emotions that you can tap into, right? That can have the same kind of powerful effect. So anyway, I noticed that and right away I was like, yeah, I need to create some kind of narrative game here. I want to do something that's really going to hammer on emotions. Because I think this, you know, I felt like VR could connect with people in a way that no other medium really could. So, yeah.
And then the trailer is out. You have a trailer for your game. And yes, I was really impressed with the trailer. I was, in terms of the story of it, like the woman comes, you know, we'll rehash it for you. You already know the story. But basically, just from what little, I'll just tell a little bit of it. And then a woman comes back to work in Deep Sea Exploration.
Right.
And is looking for Rex. I guess looking for metal. And she's talking to her boss. And her boss says, like, we miss your mom. She was an asset. And she's like, well, I'm really, and she cuts him off and says, like, well, I'm just really here for the money, pretty much. And like, and then that's like, okay, yeah, sure. Let's, you know, get back to it. And then I felt like, wow, that sets a really great stage. You set a really great table with that. Cause you're also looking at, the deep sea settings and the nice, the great graphics and stuff like that. So I was just like, wow, this is really, like this is, if this is not your first game, I was like, oh, this is a really great first game. I thought if this is.
Thanks. Yeah. No, I mean, I've done a few little things here and there in various game jams, which are kind of like, I don't know, a more familiar term to the web community might be hackathons. So it's basically like you make a game in 24 to 48 hours and it's, usually the results are pretty hilarious because you can't make a game in 24 to 48 hours. I mean, you can, but you have to be very creative and make some pretty severe cuts to what you do. So, they're very much a trial by fire. I love doing game jams just because, you know, you always end up in these situations where you're doing something you're not comfortable doing. It's way outside your comfort zone. So like in one game jam, like I just happened to, like, I'm not an audio expert by any means. I just happened to know the audio system within the Unity game engine. They're like, all right, you're doing audio for today. So I'm like, great. Like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I learned a lot in those 2 days. You know, it was, so like if anybody's listening, looking to make games, I highly recommend doing game jams because it's such a great way to just dive right in and learn. Like, you'll learn whether you want to or not. you're gonna learn stuff. But yeah, I mean, other than game jams, this is my first game. And I think part of it comes from just playing a lot of games and wanting to make games for a long time. And I do have a few friends in the film industry. Like, when I was first going into school, I thought I wanted to do film, and that lasted for about, I don't know, 3 to 6 months, where I was like, I don't want to move to Los Angeles and do the Hollywood thing for 10 years so that I can maybe someday direct Scooby-Doo 5 or something, you know, like, I don't, it's really brutally hard. And, but I have a lot of friends that did do that, you know, and they, and now they're actually starting to work on really cool stuff. And so I guess part of it comes from that kind of mindset of thinking about games in terms of a narrative medium.
And then, sorry for my call.
You're all right.
All right. Yeah. So, and you're so close to be done. Is that right? Or are you?
Yes. Yeah. So, I don't think we've said the name of the game. So the game is called Neptune Flux, mm-hmm. and it's a deep sea adventure game releasing on November 15th. Assuming no train wrecks happen. it's always possible, but yep, everything looks good for November 15th.
And it's a VR game, so it's going to be available on Oculus Rift. Is that right? I'm not a VR person, so I have no idea. No,
it's okay. So yeah, it'll be available for Rift, for HTC Vive, and it will also be available for PlayStation VR. And you can also play without a VR headset. Right. So you can play on PC and Mac through Steam, which is also how you play the Rift and Vive version. And you'll also be able to play just on a normal PlayStation 4 with or without PlayStation VR.
I'm not a big VR person, but I think that's pretty awesome. They can actually build a game in VR and also have a non-VR VR version as well. That's pretty sweet. The future is awesome.
I think that was something I designed from the beginning because, and there's no gameplay differences really. It's just kind of, it's sort of like the difference between watching a 2D movie and watching an IMAX movie.
Right.
You know, it's the same movie. You get kind of just a more enhanced experience, I guess.
Right.
I wanted to do that just because at the time that I started, it was very unclear how the VR market was really going to be by the time I was finished, or if it would even still exist. It was impossible to really tell. I wanted to make sure I supported flat gaming, as we call it, or traditional screens. It's not really a good term for it yet, but
I bring my own bias to it because I remember Vermal markup languages for VR, and so that was, I did some things for Vermal, and that was so hard to do. Like, you know, now I bet the tools are way better now, and
it's gotten a little bit better since then.
Yeah, a little bit, I think. So.
Things have improved.
I hope so. But I do love that. I love the idea of like Samsung with your phone, and I love that the hardware's gotten smaller. I just wish it was smaller. So that's,
well, it'll get there. I mean, I think right now with VR, it's just getting started. It's hard to draw analogies really, but I think in terms of the technology, I like to compare it to things like voice recognition or touchscreens, which kind of sucked for a long time. Like touchscreens in the 80s and 90s just like were not, it just seemed like they never worked right. And I remember voice recognition being promised forever, like flying cars. And I was like, yeah, that'll never happen. And now finally, you know, it's commonplace. You know, we have our phones and digital assistants, and it's a very normal thing. And I think VR falls into the same category. It's one of those things that had this vision from like the 70s or 80s, and the technology has finally caught up to that vision. It's finally reasonable to do that. And yeah, I mean, the obvious improvements are, of course, it'll get higher resolution. The cost will come down. The size and weight will come down. Pretty normal tech stuff.
Right.
But I think the big innovation is going to be what types of things we see in the new medium, because it's not just a peripheral like a gaming joystick or a gamepad or something. It's a new platform. I think it stands on its own, and I would compare it to like the web or mobile as a platform. I think we could see a time not too long from now where pretty much every business needs a VR presence of some kind. It's finding its foothold in gaming right now, but the applications stretch far beyond gaming. Same with augmented reality too, which are really kind of, they're different, but they're really all the same industry.
Right.
But yeah, I think I think just like how every web or every business needs a website and a phone app, it might not be long before every business needs some kind of a VR presence.
Yeah, I could definitely get behind augmented reality a lot because I feel like, you know, even a few years ago with Yelp, with the monocle the concept they had, like if you were walking down the street, you could actually like, you know, unlock monocle and you actually like see which businesses are nearby and walk around. I feel like, oh, that's pretty awesome. Because you're in control, but you also don't have like a Google Glass like things strapped to your head. So
yeah. But, so the thing now with augmented reality or AR is that the challenges involved are far greater than they are with VR, because you have to do well, it goes by a couple of names, but you have to do what's called inside out tracking, or SLAM, which stands for simultaneous localization and mapping. So that's the same thing that like self-driving car does. It's the same thing that the Mars rover does, where you have to map your environment in 3D and simultaneously localize yourself within that map and say, okay, I've made this map. Where am I in the map? And that way, you know, a self-driving car doesn't run into other cars. The Mars rover doesn't have to have commands issued to it to navigate around a rock. Like it can just do it and go in a kind of a straight line. And for an augmented reality headset, you need to map that environment because you have to position the headset within that environment to have those 3D tracked objects look like they are locked in space. And that it's just as hard as it sounds. I mean, it's a very, very difficult problem.
Right. But it's a problem that's been like, you know, as long as VR, like I can put out Vermal, right. Which is like no more decades, but, it's also a problem that's been worked on as well. Like trying to find a self-moving robot that's been worked on for several decades now. And I mean, you have like iRobot, you actually buy your robot and actually like goes around your room. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't know your house at all until you like, turn it on. And even then, it'll forget, you know, your house, what it looks like until if you turn it off. So, but yeah, I feel like, you know, and with your phone having like the, I forget what it's called, gyroscope or just the, being able to determine, you know, up and down and Pokemon Go, you know, just this, I think that's, I don't know. I feel like that's a really great success story. I mean, It was crazy how big it is, but I don't know how much it's dropped off since then. But since the big explosion, but yeah, I feel like but just not. I don't want, you know, I don't think Pokemon's the quintessential example of AR, but I feel like it's but being able to glean information on the go in your environment, I feel like that's pretty awesome. So
I mean, it certainly represents a good example. I guess for people that are trying to figure out what AR might be useful for. Well, I mean, you can play games, and most people like games, so that's a good example.
Yeah, and that's not bad. I mean, like the industry is awesome. I think that's pretty wonderful. I mean, like just it dwarfs the film industry. So it just I'm not I don't want to shortchange that by any stretch. I don't want to or get the impression whatsoever. So. I just know I just feel like my example has always been, I think it's probably, I feel like I'm a broken record about this, but I would love to have my 3D VR experience just be like the holograms in Star Wars, you know, when like Darth Vader is talking to his, you know, his admirals or whatever. And just like, hey, I would totally like deal with that and have that be a cool gaming experience and just have that and then have that be a shared experience in a conference room, like or hang out with people in the living room and play games with a 3D hologram.
I mean, it's pretty close. There's some things in VR right now that you can play right now. One that I've been playing a lot is called Rec Room.
Rec Room,
and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a virtual rec room, and you can go and play like ping pong with other people, and you can chat with them. A lot of these VR headsets actually have a built-in microphone, so you can just, you know, chat online. It's it's interesting because you're seeing a lot of the same ideas that you might have seen in like Ultima or The Sims Online or Second Life, where you have this shared metaverse, but they're finally like, again, it's a case of the technology finally catching up to the vision, mm-hmm. where you're like, ah, okay, here's kind of the things we were imagining with our 2D pixels. That, you know, we now have these real shared environments that feel, you know, a lot closer to the vision. But yeah, there's tons of applications. I mean, there's an IKEA app where you can actually build a kitchen.
Oh, wow.
It's just amazing to see some of the different applications that are coming out of it that are non-gaming. I'm making a game, of course, but I'm definitely interested in non-game applications just because I think that's really where it's going to find its foothold. There's a really cool one called Virtual Desktop, actually, that I think with just, you know, slightly better pricing on the headsets, better resolution, you know, I feel like we're just like a version or two away from a VR headset actually replacing a normal desktop computer.
Yeah. Well, what I love totally is the, I think this is what it is, like Samsung, you buy a Samsung phone and you slap that into your controller, mm-hmm. and that your phone is powerful enough to be your visual display into the VR world. And I feel like people will gladly carry and interface with their phone rather than, like, say, pick up a helmet or whatever and strap down on their face. If they put it on, like, a frame for their phone,
yeah,
that's a more personal object, you know, that they take with them wherever they go. And they, like, that's more a casual input into a VR world.
Yeah, totally. I mean, right now the hardware is kind of split between mobile VR, which is what that's called.
Yeah.
And the great thing about that is it's VR you can throw in a backpack. I mean, you just need the headset and a phone, and it's all wireless. And the headset itself is, so the Samsung Gear VR, I think, is only like $100 or something. And then, I mean, of course, you need the phone to go with it. But for most people, that's kind of a sunk cost. They already have the phone. So that's a really attractive option. And then there's, I guess, high-end VR, right? Which is like your Oculus Rift, your HTC Vive. The things you get out of that are, you know, much higher fidelity graphics. They have positional tracking, which turns out to be really, really important in a lot of instances. So that means you can actually move your head and not just look around and rotate, but also move positionally. So you can like lean around a corner, or look under things, and you know, they provide two different experiences. But I think for, you know, mobile VR is very attractive to developers because consumers look at the two options and they say, wait, so I can buy the wireless headset for $99 and just use my phone, or I can buy a desktop computer and this more expensive headset, and it has a wire. Why would I do that? You know, and I mean, if you've tried both, like, you know the difference, and high-end VR is kind of like what you want. But I think ultimately, like I said, I mean, it's just like anything in technology. Like, it'll become wireless, it'll become cheap, it'll probably, like, they'll probably become one and the same pretty soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's only going to get smaller and smaller and less wires, so.
Totally.
Yeah. Cool, awesome. Well, I think it's a good time. How can people, your game's coming out November 15th, is that, or?
Yep.
November 15th. How can they find your game?
So if you just go on Steam and search for Neptune Flux, it should be on there. You can also go to neptuneflux.com. I mean, it'll also be on the PlayStation Network. So it doesn't have a store presence there just yet, but it should soon. But yeah.
And how can people find you elsewhere on the internet?
So I'm on Twitter. I am at Nick RP on Twitter. The RP is just my middle and last name initial. And yeah, I don't know. That's probably the best place to find me. I'm not much for other social networks. I'm mostly on Twitter. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Nick. This has been great. This has been awesome.
Yeah, no problem. It's been fun.
And congratulations on the game.
Thanks.
That's awesome.
Thanks. I'll take the congratulations when it's actually out.
Oh, dude.
Take a rain check on it.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.